When you think of Gallipoli, which journalists spring to mind? If you're like me, it's Charles Bean and Keith Murdoch. If you know a bit more, you're probably aware of Ellis Ashmead Bartlett of London's Daily Telegraph. How about Philip Schuller of The Age? Mark Baker of the Melbourne Press Club says he was enormously important.
His war began right at the beginning. Indeed, he travelled with the first convoy to Egypt in late 1914, and he was with the troops in training in Egypt. And he travelled aboard the Orvieto, which was the flagship of that first convoy, and one of his companions on that vessel, amongst as well as some of the senior officers, was Charles Bean, of course, the official correspondent.
Yes, and in those days, in those very early days, when they're on board the ships, and I think it was the biggest group of military ships to leave Australia at that point, it was sort of an adventure, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, they didn't know where they were going. I think predominantly they expected that they were going to England, and it wasn't until quite late in the piece, I think, that they became aware that they were, that Egypt was the destination and that they were going to camp and into training there.
So he couldn't get to Gallipoli the official way because only one war correspondent, who turned out to be Charles Bean, of course, could go.
Yes, the rules in those days were there was one official correspondent, I think, for each of those nations. I think it was the same for Britain as well. So there was a ballot of the Journalist Union, and that ballot was won by Charles Bean. Keith Murdoch was, in fact, the runner-up. But the decision was taken by The Age newspaper, where Schuller worked, and indeed his father was the editor of the paper, which may have been helpful to him. But The Age decided that that Schuller would go as their official representative, and so he travelled. But of course he did not, because he wasn't the official correspondent, once the decision was made to embark on the Gallipoli campaign, he was not allowed to cover the landings and not allowed to go ashore because he wasn't official. So he had to cool his heels, and he and a lot of other correspondents, British correspondents and some Australians, travelled to the Greek islands, sort of hung about a bit, picked up as much as they could from the sidelines. And at the same time, Schuller put a lot of work into badgering General Sir Ian Hamilton, the commander of the Gallipoli operation, for permission. And ultimately, Hamilton, who had met Schuller when he came to Australia in early 1914 to inspect the Australian troops, agreed and, as he put it, bent the rules because he thought Philip Schuller was a good chap. And so Schuller got permission and he went ashore in late July 1915, and indeed was there critically in time for those huge August and very deadly August offensives.
Well, I'll ask you about those in a moment, but that period of time where him and other correspondents are in the Greek islands and then they get a boat and they go and have a look at the peninsula, as it were, it doesn't sound too hard in terms of journalistic efforts. But it sounds like a lot of fun, actually. But he does eventually get there, as you say, in July. And early on, he was writing in particular about the poor medical treatment of the soldiers, wasn't he?
Yes, well, he indeed broke a lot of the stories, which had considerable impact, about the poor facilities and procedures for the handling of the wounded, which, of course, led to many additional deaths and, it was argued, unnecessary deaths because there were inadequate provisions made. Although, of course, the extent of the bloodshed was far more substantial, I guess, than it had been anticipated at the start. Well, he wrote extensively about that and very powerfully, and those dispatches certainly had a big impact back home and led to a number of changes and reforms being instituted.
He also, as you mentioned, covered the fighting itself, including those desperate actions in August, like, for example, the Battle of Lone Pine.
Yes, well, he got ashore, as I said, in late July, and it was certainly there at the beginning of August, covered Lone Pine and the Battle of the Neck, and saw at very close quarters, indeed, a lot of that very serious fighting. And indeed, at that point, Charles Bean was indisposed. He was ill, had resisted evacuation, was basically sort of holed up in his dugout. Schuller shared the dugout with Bean, and to some extent, I think, nursed Bean or helped Bean while he was out of action, but also, I think, assisted Bean by supplying him with a lot of information from his eyes and ears travelling to the forward trenches in those days.
So how were they? How was he and indeed Bean getting their stories out? You know, it's difficult to imagine that these days. Of course, you know, you tap it out on the computer and link to your mobile phone, and off it goes. But in those days, it would have been quite a palaver.
Yeah, it was horrendously difficult. I think even for Bean, who was official and therefore had the inside track, it took ages. Their stuff was indeed, of course, heavily censored. And they had to sort of wait in line for their stuff to be sent via cable. It was difficult for Bean. It was certainly difficult for Shula. So a lot of the dispatches did take quite a while to see the light of day. But, of course, in those days they weren't competing with radio and TV, so you could kind of afford to a bit of time lag and still have a good story.
How important was his coverage of Gallipoli, Mark?
I think it was very important. I think it's the view of many that his writing and his reports, his dispatches were terrifically good journalism. He wrote powerfully and with great passion. You know, he like all of the correspondents of that time, he was deeply impressed by the bravery and the courage and the derring do of a lot of the Australian soldiers. But at this distance, we kind of see that as being a little bit jingoistic and over the top. But he was there, he saw it and was, you know, reasonably and legitimately impressed by it. But beyond that, he was quite dispassionate. He had great respect and wrote very respectfully and indeed applauded the courage and sacrifice of the Turkish troops too. So it wasn't sort of one-eyed cheering. But his reporting was very, very good, and indeed, in the view of some, he was a better reporter out of Gallipoli than Charles Bean was.
Because we think of Bean, and we think of Keith Murdoch, when we think of the Australian journalists covering the Dardanelles campaign. And we don't, I mean, I had not heard of Philip Shula until I read your piece.
Well, I guess part of the reason is that after Gallipoli, he came home, he wrote a very good book, which we're now seeing republished, which is terrific. But in July or June, I think, 1917, by which stage he had enlisted and had gone to the Western Front as a soldier. He was ultimately commissioned, but he was killed in action on the Western Front. So he'd produced the first full-length book on Gallipoli, and it was a very well-received book. But then, of course, he was killed not long after that. So unlike Bean and Murdoch, who went on to very illustrious post-war careers and were able to sort of propagate the story of their involvement, Shula was no longer there. But there's a great legacy, of course, not only in the book. Shula was a very good photographer, amateur photographer, but he took a lot, you know, many hundreds of images, many of which are amongst the most recognisable and powerful images that we have of the Gallipoli campaign. I mean, some of the pictures we see on book covers over the years, Les Carline's book, the cover is a Shula photograph. So there's a great legacy there in his photography.
What I'm interested in finding out was why enlist? I mean, he'd already demonstrated that he was a fine reporter, especially for such a young man. Why did he feel that reporting on the war was not enough, almost?
Well, I've been through a lot of the papers, his correspondence and correspondence with other figures, and it's clear that he was very powerfully affected, who wouldn't be, by what he saw at Gallipoli. He came home, he wrote his book, and I think he felt, having seen the sacrifice, had seen what the Australian soldiers went through, that it was not good enough from his point of view to simply, as he could well have done, take an armchair ride to the Western Front as a then well-known and distinguished correspondent and reported on that. He wanted to fight. He enlisted. He had been an officer in the militia before the war, and therefore I believe he would automatically, almost automatically, have got a commission as an officer. But he refused that. He enlisted as a private and went to war as a driver with Monash's divisional train.
And
therefore, to answer your question, I think it was an act of, I need to do my bit. Mm. And he paid the price for that, obviously.
I have to ask, Mark, why do you think he was so good? Because you're obviously very convinced he was, and that book that he wrote was very well received. Was it an ability to to talk to everybody, or an ability to understand what was happening in the at the senior levels of command at Gallipoli? What did he have?
Well, you read the book and it gives you a lot of insights. You know, I'd say today, if someone like Shula came along, he's a natural. You know, he's a young guy. He'd gone to law school. He dropped out after a year. He'd been brawling with his father, who wasn't happy with him. He had quite an active social life, and I think he was a bit listless. He came into journalism only 3 or 4 years before he went to war, but he did very well immediately. He found his calling. He loved it, got in it, and obviously went and was very purposeful with what he did. You know, while he didn't go to the landing, he was getting around, getting information, doing it in a very proficient and professional way. But he had a great touch. He got on well with people. He clearly made terrific friendships through the ranks and also amongst officers. In fact, a big part of the story which I'll be developing is he developed a great friendship with Sir Ian Hamilton, and he and Hamilton had corresponded quite intensively with each other right up until just before Shula was killed, which is quite remarkable because you've got this legendary general, albeit had sort of been sacked at the end of the Gallipoli campaign, but this friendship abided between he and this junior officer on the Western Front.
Mark, it's a fantastic story. Thank you very much for coming on the Media Report to tell us all about it.
My great pleasure.
Mark Baker's writing a book about Philip Shula, and you can hear a lot more about World War I next weekend, not the one coming up, but Saturday the 28th, Sunday the 29th. It's RN's Great War Weekend. Don't miss it. That's it for now. Thanks to producer Kyla Slaven, sound engineer Martin Peralta. I'm Richard Adey.